Hello, everyone. I'm Sam Hansen.
And I'm Sadie Witkowski.
And you are listening to Carry the Two, a podcast from the Institute for Mathematical and Statistical Innovation, aka IMSI.
This is the podcast where Sam and I talk about the real-world applications of mathematical and statistical research.
Here we are, back again, Sadie.
Back and ready for yet another emerging technology episode, Sam.
Good. Because we have a great one this time. It ties together everything from astronomy to medicine, the matrix to our phones, and light to darkness. But at its heart, it's all about taking in data from a wide range of sensors and making it legible to humans.
No one can look at the raw data and do anything meaningful with it. We really need a computer to take that data and form an image that a human can interpret and extract knowledge from. And so that process is computational imaging.
That was Rebecca Willett,
the Warraw Family Professor of Statistics and Computer Science in the Wallman Society of Fellows at the University of Chicago.
And Rebecca works in computational imaging?
As well as many other areas, including the mathematical and statistical foundations of machine learning, which will come up later.
Exciting. I can't wait. But first, I'm guessing we're going to take a dive into just what computational imaging is.
How about we start with imaging itself on its own first?
You know what? That does sound reasonable.
Great. So imaging works by capturing light from what we're trying to image.
Ah, and initially we did this with film, and now we're using digital sensors of some sort?
Exactly, as Rebecca explained to me.
Each measurement would correspond to how much light is coming from each particular location in space. So like how bright is the red light and the green light and the blue light at each individual pixel?
But since these are indirect measurements of the brightness, there could be issues with them.
So they could be contaminated by blur, for instance.
Or even
in astronomy with telescopes, the thing that we want to make an image of can be distorted by things like dark matter.
Oh, wow. I had no idea dark matter could cause that to happen.
Neither did I. And that isn't the only issue that can affect things like telescopes, but I'm getting ahead of myself.
Yeah, no spoilers, Sam.
Sorry, I'll keep it spoiler-free from now on. Rebecca did want us to know that this red-green-blue paradigm is only for standard commercial cameras. And in the scientific world, they could be dealing with multispectral imaging.
We might get measurements or care about information about how much light there is at much finer different wavelengths. So maybe even hundreds or thousands of different wavelengths of light.
That is a whole lot more than just three colors. Like a mantis shrimp worth of colors.
What now?
Mantis shrimp? The crustaceans that are famous for their ability to see a truly amazing spread of different light wavelengths.
Gotcha, but let's stick with human technology for now?
Okay, but maybe we could learn something from the mantis shrimp.
Perhaps we could, Sadie, but trust me, I will make today's conversation worth your while. In fact, let's start with some technology in your pocket right now, and which our audience is probably using to listen to us.
But I want to emphasize, even with modern phone cameras, there's a lot of computational imaging actually happening under the hood that's really invisible to you and me.
Beyond the obvious of translating the measurements taken by the digital sensors into an image, what sort of computations are our phones doing?
There's been a lot of careful engineering and work being done to make sure that those cameras are as compact as possible.
And this engineering has led to some issues as far as imaging is concerned.
That does introduce all different kinds of distortions due to, say, the lens design. And so computational imaging is being used to undo that distortion.
And that's not it. There's also how our phones and other modern digital cameras handle low lighting.
Back when I was a kid, if you took a picture where there was very little light, the resulting image was extremely grainy looking. But now with modern computational imaging methods, we can take images in low light and get very high quality images coming out due to the use of different computational and mathematical methods.
For sure. Even over the last few years of phones, it's really noticeable how much better they are at taking photos at night.
I know. I recently upgraded after having a phone for like 7 years, and I had to get used to the idea that I could actually take photos at night, thanks to the much more advanced processing capabilities that the new phone had.
Speaking of those capabilities, and I know this is usually your role, but can we please talk about the math and stats that power them?
Oh, phew, I'm sorry. I'm failing at my job today. Okay, let's start with how computational imaging has traditionally functioned.
The classical methods would exploit the fact that for most images that you and I would look at, they have some common features. For instance, they've got smooth surfaces that are separated by smooth boundaries. And so even if the raw data looks really grainy, we can infer that perhaps the true image that we care about is not grainy, and that a smoother version would be more accurate of a representation of the true scene.
So they leverage these common features and...
You can use a combination of statistical models of the graininess or noise in the image that we collect, and mathematical models of the kind of geometry or structure of the image that we care about, like smoothness of various types, in order to computationally search for an image that's a good fit to both, that is a good fit to the data in a statistical sense, and which is a good fit to what we know about the geometry of images that we typically see.
In other words,
nominally, what we want to do is we want to search over all possible images to find the one where, if we send it through this model of how our measurement system works, is a good fit to what we actually observe.
But what if there are a bunch of different possible images that fit the observations?
Now you're the one spoiling things.
We have to deal with a problem that within the mathematical community is called ill-posedness of the problem.
Which is the technical way of saying what you just said, Sadie, that the problem may not have a unique solution. For computational imaging, this means...
We just go for the absolute best fit. It might not be something that is accurate. It might be overfitting to the noise or to errors in the data.
That sounds like an absolute nightmare to handle. And if hosting this show for all these years has taught me anything, I know that this means there is some math or stats coming.
Well, let me prove you right.
We use a mathematical technique called regularization.
Ha! I knew it.
And yeah, you did. And regularization relies on the fact that in most computational imaging tasks, the type of images being created are predictable ahead of time.
With regularization, I'm saying when I look at all the images that are a good fit to my data, I want to choose the one of those images that is the most regular, that is the most smoothness, or which is most consistent with my prior understanding of what images should look like.
Not that it's easy to create these regularizers. It is a really active area of research.
I want to construct a mathematical model of the geometry that I think should be present in images. And those tools are very powerful. It led to a lot of deep mathematics and interesting insights.
I noticed a bit of a past tense shift in Rebecca's answer there. Has there been a shift in how this regularization is being handled?
Good ear. There has been. And like so many times before this season, it's time to start talking about the impact of machine learning.
In the field of machine learning and AI, we have huge collections of different images. And so instead of us writing down a mathematical model of the geometry of images, can we use machine learning to extract a model of the geometry automatically?
And with well-curated data sets, these machine learning regularizers outperform most simple mathematical ones. But
the real question is, how well is this going to work in the wild, right?
That is always the question.
And it's not the only one. There is another very important question that Rebecca shared.
How much training data do I need, and how diverse does it need to be?
I know the quantity of training data is always important, but why focus on the diversity?
If my training data is all a bunch of medical images, and it all corresponds to images of healthy people, then is using a regularizer that's learned from those healthy images going to make it so that when I try to reconstruct an image of someone who's not healthy, who maybe has a tumor or lesion, is that tumor or lesion going to get erased, regularized out?
Oh, of course. It is the out of distribution prediction question all over again.
Exactly. And while with the mathematical models, it was possible to determine what sort of images would be preferred, it's much harder with the machine learning regularizers. And
this is not about doing good searches for images of cats on the internet, where a mistake has a very low cost. And so we really need to understand what the failure modes are. We need to give people guidance about how much data they should plan on using to train these different AI systems, and how I can evaluate and test these systems to ensure that they're going to be robust to errors, or so that people can trust them.
Trusting my phone camera, I can take or leave personally, but phones are being used more and more for reporting, and I would like to be able to trust that. And I definitely want to be able to trust my medical imaging.
Not to mention the imaging being used in construction and engineering.
I hadn't even thought of those. So what are they doing in order to figure out how to make these systems trustworthy?
One of the main approaches is using benchmarks against shared data sets.
We've got the same training data set and the same test data set that everyone working in an area will use. And this is helpful because now we can do side-by-side comparisons of different approaches. And as a community, we get a sense of what makes a bigger or smaller impact on performance.
Though, these benchmark tests have those same out-of-distribution or distribution drift issues that we mentioned before, which can mean that they may not be as useful a measure as hoped for.
So if we only rely on empirical measures of how well we do on a curated training and test set on a benchmark data set, we really risk missing challenges that will arise when these systems are deployed. And that's why understanding the mathematical foundations is really important. It's going to capture potential challenges and pitfalls that we might miss if we only rely on benchmarks.
And in order to really get to trustworthy algorithmic computational imaging tools, Rebecca thinks that a paradigm shift needs to happen.
I think that we should have more value placed on creative out there ideas that really shift us away from everybody doing exactly the same kind of approach.
Can't argue with that.
Definitely not. And speaking of shifting, I would like us to talk about an application of computational imaging next. But don't worry, we will hear from Rebecca again before the end of the episode.
Okay. So what is the application?
Well, I have two to share, but I wanted to let you decide where we should go first. Do you want to hear how math, stats, and computation can help us image things at really short timescales or really long distances first?
Let's go with distances.
In that case, let me introduce you to...
I'm Stanley Chan. I'm a professor at Purdue University.
Stanley works in computational imaging and optics. In particular,
we work on imaging for a very long distance.
And what are the particular issues that this distance brings up?
Because our atmosphere is not vacuum, we have air flowing, you will be impacted substantially by the flowing air.
Of course, pesky atmosphere. Sure, it makes it possible to live, but is it worth it if our imaging is impacted?
Ha ha ha. Joking aside, the atmosphere really does make a difference.
Ideally, in vacuum, that means in space, light will travel through a straight line.
While in an atmosphere,
because of the less changing air, the light wouldn't travel in a straight line.
To put it more scientifically,
because the atmosphere is always changing, we have hot air, we have cold air, and so the refractive index will change in space and in time.
Oh! This is like a thermocline you sometimes see when scuba diving. It's this rapid transition in water temperature over just a few feet of depth, and you can actually visually see it as this shimmer where the light is bending around this change.
Oh, that's so cool. If I ever get the chance to go scuba diving, I really hope I see one.
Physically uncomfortable, but beautiful to see.
So the refractive index here means that the speed of light in the atmosphere versus the speed of light in a vacuum. And the index directly impacts the wave function that we can use to describe light.
For any wave function that is an amplitude, that's also a phase, the phase will lead or the phase will lag. So going forward, going backward, depending on the refractive index.
And what does this phase lag mean for imaging?
Well, for moment-to-moment observation, it means the light is dancing around and shifting. And when you measure these observations for an image,
then all these jittering things will accumulate. That will give you the blur.
In other words, if you are imaging something very far away,
it just affects your perception a lot. You cannot tell, okay, is it a car? Is it a person? What is the words on the license plate of that car?
In fact, if you have ever spent some time in a desert, your eyes may have had this exact same issue.
Who drove in Nevada or Utah before, where you are in the desert, hot air, you should have good experience of those, right? So we're talking about those kind of distortions.
I know exactly what he's talking about. That sort of heat blur and the haze that makes the road ahead look all wibbly wobbly and leads to the oasis mirage effect.
And do you know where mirages are not welcome?
I mean, I don't think anyone really wants to see a mirage, but I'll bite. Where are mirages not welcome?
Astronomy.
So you look at a star, you know it is a star, it's a bright star, and you start to take a picture of those and you measure the phase. Now, if there is no distortion, everything should be perfect. But if there is any distortion, you can use a device called the wavefront sensor.
And so how does this wavefront sensor help?
Well, it detects the phase, and then using a technique called adaptive optics, deformable mirrors can be shifted around to cancel out the phase delays, making the image clear.
I believe you, but I'm not quite following. How is it that mirrors can cancel out phase delays?
Let's try it this way. Have you ever been to the optometrist?
Yeah.
So you know all the measurements they take.
Basically, what they're measuring is the phase delay of your human lens, okay? And they say, oh yeah, your lens is causing so much delay along this angle, and then so much along that angle. Then when they prescribe the glass, they will pre-compensate the light for the distortions.
And adaptive optics work the same way.
The deformable mirror actually works in a very similar way. You use a wavefront sensor or use our algorithm, you can measure the phase, and then you use the deformable mirror to pre-compensate the phase.
That's really cool. And that would mean that ground-based telescopes that have to see through the atmosphere and can use stars to measure phase delays are in good shape. But it doesn't exactly solve the is it a car or is it a person conundrum, does it?
Sadly, no.
For ground-to-ground applications, this technique would be a lot harder, because why would somebody put a reference point next to a target?
And it's not just the lack of a reference point. Wavefront sensors and deformable mirrors can cancel out distortions, but they're really, really slow, and ground-to-ground long-distance imaging requires speed.
So we know how to take a blurry image quickly, or a clear image slowly.
Yep.
Well, that's just great.
Well, if you were in this situation, what question would you ask?
Is there any way to take a blurry image and make it clear?
And that is why you have a PhD.
No other reason.
What you can do is you have to take a picture. And from the picture, you need to estimate the phase, because now you can measure. So the estimation process is called a phase retrieval.
And this is nice and easy, right?
I know you know better than that. From how Rebecca described imaging earlier, we know that what a picture gives us is the intensity of the light. And just a second, are you ready for some mathy talk?
Always.
Good. So this intensity can be thought of as the amplitude of a complex number. In other words, if you take a coordinate grid where the x-axis are real numbers and the y-axis are imaginary numbers, the amplitude is how far from the origin or the zero-zero point the complex number is.
Okay, so like a two-dimensional absolute value.
Exactly. But while the absolute value of x equaling 5 means that x is either positive or negative 5, the amplitude of a complex number being 1 only means that the complex number is one of an infinite number of different complex numbers that lie on the circle of radius 1 around the origin.
And finding out which one of the numbers it is the phase retrieval problem.
Yeah.
And what I want is the phase, which is the angle.
But how do they narrow down to one answer if there are an infinity of possibilities?
Similarly to how Rebecca did, by using the fact that image data is not totally random.
Then the problem will actually be possible because we know images, they are not random combination of values, right? So there's an edge, there is a corner, there's a tree, there's a flower, they have structures.
And this means that the values of neighboring pixels are not independent of one another. Instead, they're correlated.
So when pixels, they are correlated, then I can use the neighboring information to do the inference.
Of course, just because it's possible doesn't mean that it's easy.
And we've been trying to solve the phase retrieval problem following the literature by designing neural networks. And we have a poor student, graduate student, who have been working on this problem for a long, long time, train big and small giant neural networks with all kinds of architectures, with tons of millions of image examples. He cannot solve the problem.
Poor student. That certainly sounds frustrating.
I know, but thankfully, they eventually figured out what one of their main issues was, and it was a surprising one.
We found that when you have a circular lens, solving the phase retrieval problem is very hard.
It was the shape of the lens?
It surprised me too, but once Stanley started to explain, it all clicked.
You rotate a circle, you get the same thing. And this creates what we call the ambiguity.
Huh. Why does that matter?
Well, it all comes down to machine learning algorithms not really knowing things like we know things.
So the example would be I give the neural network x squared. I ask, hey, tell me whether the solution is square root of x or minus square root of x. Now, the neural network wouldn't know whether it should take the positive side or the negative side. And so when you present the training pair, it will start become very puzzled. And it will just jump up and down. And this is what we observe. It's oscillating. It never converges. It just never, never, ever give you what you want.
Oh, yeah. I guess a machine learning system would have a hard time telling the difference between a circle and itself rotated a bit and wouldn't know which to choose. And with this problem, it wouldn't be just two options it's bouncing between either.
Which is why they decided to make a change.
We say, hey, we should give away the circle. Circle is really causing a lot of trouble. So we propose to do a triangle, a pentagon, anything that is asymmetrical.
And did that help? Actually, wait a second. How did they go from circular lenses to triangular ones? How do you even machine a triangular lens?
Very easily, it turns out.
You take a piece of paper, you cut a triangle, put it on top of. That's it.
Really? That's it?
I'm still getting over it myself.
Okay, back to my earlier question. Did it help?
That helped us narrow down the solution space from infinitely many solutions down to just a unique solution.
Or in other words, saying that it helped might just be an understatement. So with a non-circular lens, their machine learning networks are very happy. But there's still something else that Stanley was hoping for.
Then we ask, can we make it small? Okay, can we make the network small, make it fast, so that we can operate in real time?
Stanley doesn't aim low, does he?
Definitely not.
And so what we did is that we say, maybe we just need a simple representation for both the point spread function and also the phase.
Where the point spread function is another way of saying the observed pattern, aka the input to the neural network. So they decided to see if they could handle it like we handle things like image compression.
I'm sorry, but image compression?
Oh, yeah, I guess I should have probably explained that. So, you know those letters after the dot and image file names?
Yeah, like PNG, JPEG, BMP, TIFF.
Exactly. Each one of those is a different image compression, file compression type.
For those of you who are familiar with JPEG compression, you throw away 80% of the signals and keep 20%, you can still see the pretty good image. And why don't we just capture the 20% of the signal?
Yeah. So they were trying to come up with a way of representing the observed image input and the phase output in a compressed way.
And all of a sudden, if you're thinking this way, the input points per function can be 100 by 100 pixels. So that will be easily 100,000 pixel values. But by using the representation, we may only need 100 coefficients. Similarly, for the phase, you may need 100,000 values, but now you only need maybe 30 coefficients.
And once they had these compressed representations,
when we did the training, it turns out that the operation is very, very fast.
And while his system is not quite ready for prime time yet, Stanley thinks that once it can be implemented, it will be a real game changer for resolution, speed, and cost of long distance imaging.
So I can implement it on a telescope to replace the wavelength sensor with a much faster operating speed. It would be much lower cost because I do not need to spend $10,000 to buy the wavelength sensor. I just need to use an algorithm to recover. And I can also track much faster objects instead of a stationary planet.
I'm sure a lot of astronomers will be happy to not have to have a 10,000 sensor to buy.
Right? And Stanley is such a nice person that he was having none of it when I suggested that he could use turning circular lenses into asymmetric ones as a capitalistic opportunity.
So if it's $10,000 for a wavefront sensor, what are you going to charge for the little 3D printed triangles, like $500, $600? Like, that seems like a great cost savings.
It could be in the order of $10 or even less.
He really is leaving money on the table.
I know.
So that's the long distance computational imaging. Is it time now for short time scales?
Right after this message from the University of Chicago Podcast Network, it is. If you're tired of hearing the same stories about climate and energy, there's a new UCPN podcast that you should check out. It's called Shocked! Each episode, you'll hear Amy Harder and economist Michael Greenstone share new ways of thinking about climate change and cutting-edge solutions, like changing the Earth's atmosphere, making batteries out of sodium, and using AI to predict the weather. To listen to Shocked, search for Shocked in your podcast app. That's Shocked.
From the exosecond scale down to the attosecond scale, it's basically all the time scales that we've managed to observe as humans.
Who is this throwing around these types of seconds I've never heard about before?
I'm David Lindell. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Toronto in the Department of Computer Science.
David does research on computational imaging and computer vision, in particular, focusing on imaging across timescales. We started by talking about standard cameras, like the ones in our phones.
These cameras would operate and allow you to freeze motion at timescales of a fraction of a second, maybe a hundredth of a second, perhaps a thousandth of a second.
Though we do have consumer access to cameras that shoot at much shorter timescales too.
You can buy off-the-shelf, high-end, high-speed cameras that can capture a scene at perhaps a million frames per second. And that's fast enough to capture, for example, a speeding bullet traveling through a scene.
And scientists? They have access to even shorter ones.
And so there are specialized techniques that allow you to push to billions or trillions or even quadrillions, effectively, quadrillions of frames per second, but they operate on a completely different paradigm.
And finally, thanks to the work of Pierre Agostini, Ferenc Kraus, Inez Lehoulier, and their teams,
We have now developed attosecond lasers. The Nobel Prize in Physics was awarded for this invention a couple of years ago. And they can actually use this to probe the dynamics of electrons moving around molecules at attosecond time periods.
Okay, wait a minute. What is an attosecond?
An attosecond is 10 to the negative 18th of a second. And since the universe is less than 10 to the 18th seconds old, there are more attoseconds in a single second than there have been seconds since the start of the universe.
Wow. So what you're saying is unfathomably short.
Yeah. And so from the unfathomably short, let's go to the unfathomably long.
For example, I've seen images where scientists are trying to monitor the behavior of glaciers that are moving at glacially slow paces, and that the change in the position of how these glaciers are structured happens over many years. So you can actually see time lapses over decades.
But decades isn't unfathomable yet. So let's keep going.
And then if you move to more unconventional techniques, like the James Webb Space Telescope or the Hubble Space Telescope, and you look far out into space, you can basically capture events that have happened from close to the present time all the way back 13 billion years near the formation of the universe.
Which isn't really a full exosecond, which is 10 to the 18th seconds, but we can round up.
Yeah, that's unfathomable. And yet you're telling me that we have imaged at both scales?
We have, though, as you can expect, it requires a lot of cool science and math and stats to accomplish.
I bet. And I'm guessing that David is working on the forefront of that cool science and math and stats.
He is, in particular, with really short timescale imaging. Before we get to that, though, we should start with how high-speed imaging first took off.
The modern paradigm of high-speed imaging was really pioneered by Doc Edgerton, who was a professor at MIT, and one of the fundamental innovators of high-speed imaging.
And Doc Edgerton's paradigm used two main principles.
And the first is the use of a high-speed flash, like a strobe light.
As well as?
The second principle is synchronization of that high-speed flash or strobe light to a scene or to the camera that you're using to image.
And David shared an example of how Doc Edgerton applied these two principles to achieve high-speed images.
He shows a fan that's spinning around at a high speed. If you take an image of this fan with a conventional camera, it would be blurred out. The fan would be moving during the exposure time. You get a blurry image. But if you apply Edgerton's two principles, a high-speed flash, like a strobe light, and you synchronize that flash to the revolutions of the fan, so it flashes on and the fan is in a certain position in its revolution, and then the strobe light turns off, and then when it flashes on again, the fan is at the same position. You just flash the strobe light like that. With your own eyes, you'll see the fan blade frozen in position. And now it becomes very easy to capture a high-speed image. You simply just expose your sensor to that scene, and it will collect photons from that fan that's frozen in position, and you can leave the exposure open as long as you'd like to collect enough photons to form a clean image.
These principles can also be extended to video as well as still images.
If you want to capture a video sequence of this fan spinning, all you have to do is slightly delay the strobe light sequence so that it captures the fan in a slightly different position. Then if you delay it a bit more, the fan moves a bit more. And in this way, you can basically assemble an entire sequence of images that would result in a nice video of this fan moving very slowly over time.
Anyone who's ever watched people dance or dance themselves under a strobe light can totally picture how this is done.
That's exactly how I was imagining it too. And over time, lasers started to replace strobes until...
In practice, we can image things that are much faster than fans. We can even image light itself moving.
Incredible. But I sense that David is working on something even cooler.
He is. And it has a cool name too.
A single photon avalanche diode is a type of light sensing device, type of sensor, that measures light by triggering every time a single photon is detected.
So while pixels in conventional sensors are like buckets that collect light intensity while exposed, David prefers a different analogy for these single photon avalanche diodes, or SPADs.
This pixel is more like like a mousetrap. A photon can come in and it has a chance with some relatively high probability to trigger that trap. And that results in an avalanche of current produced by this device that can be detected by ultra-fast timing circuitry. And at the output of this device, you then get a timestamp of when that photon arrived.
These diodes sound cool, but how does one go from detecting a photon to the measure of the amount of light needed for imaging?
Is there a way to relate the time at which individual photons are arriving to the underlying intensity of the scene? So this is exactly what we've been working on in our group at the University of Toronto.
Of course they are.
Not only that, they got results.
We discovered that there is a very interesting connection between the timestamps of the incident photons that you detect with the SPAT array and the underlying intensity of light that's incident onto the sensor.
And this brings us to some really fun math. Let's start with how high-speed imaging has traditionally been thought of in a mathematical sense.
The conventional view of high-speed videography is that you've got some light that's incident on your sensor, and you can think of this as a continuous time-varying function of the incident intensity of light.
Which mathematically means?
So there's some continuous function that describes the amount of light coming onto my sensor, and my high-speed camera just samples this function.
So for faster images,
if I want to push to higher speeds, I can just sample this continuous function at a higher and a higher rate.
Except when pushed to a short enough time scale, this breaks down.
Reason for that is that light is not continuous. It's made up of individual particles called photons that are arriving onto the sensor discretely, stochastically, and asynchronously.
And if we stick with the pixel sensor bucket analogy, we can also think of light at these really high speeds as a faucet that's leaking.
And that leaky faucet will, if you put a bucket under it, you might fill a bucket of water every hour. So there's some average amount of flow coming out of this faucet that you can characterize. But the individual water droplets are coming down randomly at different times, and they're coming down one at a time.
Which brings us back to the SPAD. Because unlike the conventional sensors, they will capture those water droplets and the exact time they arrived. And David and his team found that by analyzing these statistically, they found out
there's a connection between the discrete world of individual photons that are arriving and the continuous world of what I'll call time-varying incident flux, or the intensity of light.
And this connection allows them to use the SPADs to create images?
After using some stochastic calculus and Fourier analysis and statistics, they did. And after they did, they realized that it allowed them to do something that traditional high-speed imaging never did.
So Edgerton's principle is really a double-edged sword. It allows you to freeze a particular phenomenon in time, but you can't really freeze multiple things moving at different speeds together.
Or in other words, if you wanted to capture both a spinning fan and the propagation of light through the same scene, you couldn't do that using standard techniques. But that's no longer a limitation.
We simply use a SPAD, and at every point in the scene, we collect photon timestamps. We reconstruct the continuous time-varying flux at that point, and we get flux functions for every point in the scene, which you can think of as like a 3D function of the time-varying flux. We get over the two spatial dimensions of the scene and then over time.
To put it a different way,
this is a video, a continuous video that you can play back at any speed. So that is what we can capture using a combination of very precise photon timestamping enabled by SPADs and the computational algorithms we developed that allow you to map from photon timestamps to time-varying flux.
That I want to see.
And I'm going to share an example with you soon. But first, I got a question. Do you remember The Matrix?
Keanu Reeves, human batteries, virtual reality accessible through landlines? Yeah, I remember The Matrix.
And do you remember Bullet Time?
The slow motion effect where it looks like Neo or an agent can dodge bullets? Come on, you know I remember that too.
Okay. In order to create those shots, The Wachowskis had to work with their visual effects crew to create a 121 high-speed camera system that shot from all angles and then used frames from individual cameras to create the effect.
So what does this have to do with David and his spats?
We wondered if we could take this type of sequence and increase the speed of it by a factor of millions. So not like a bullet time effect, but like a light speed bullet effect.
Which they did.
We built a setup where you have a SPAD camera on a gantry, and you can capture a pulse of light illuminating a scene from one viewpoint, move the SPAD camera, capture it, that same sequence from another viewpoint. We basically just repeat the illumination of the scene in exactly the same way for every viewpoint. We can artificially create the same sort of sequence that as was done in this VFX shot in The Matrix.
What they did was take a known image of light refracting through a bottle from Andreas Felton and collaborators in Ramesh Raskar's lab at MIT and imaged it using their SPAD array, and the video is spectacular. I mean, look at this from the recording of the talk David gave at MC.
Oh my gosh, that's so trippy. It's almost spooky that you can see both the light and all the reflections and such.
I know this is an audio program, so let me have David describe it.
With this bullet time light speed effect, you can actually move the camera around the Coke bottle and see the light propagating through it, refracting out of the plastic, scattering around from any viewpoint.
Those words do not start to do it justice.
I know. I really do. So I think what everyone should do is go check out his talk on the MC website, imsi.institute, where you can see that specific video starting at 23 minutes and 58 seconds in. But you should really watch the whole talk, as it's filled with similarly spectacular high-speed videos.
Oh yeah, they should. I mean, I know I'm going to watch the whole thing.
And also, I will make sure to link it in our show notes. And just, I really want people to watch it. It's great. All of that said, it's worth remembering that this work of David and his collaborators is really bleeding edge. As he says,
I think our work opens up a whole unknown frontier of imaging on this point.
And he has no idea where it's going.
I'm hoping to be surprised, and I'm hoping there's some unexpected things that we can discover by just taking our cameras and this technique and capturing some things with it.
Not that he doesn't have ideas.
I want to do this experiment where you just point one of our cameras out at the city skyline and you see what's happening at different timescales.
Huh. What does that mean?
Here's how David described it to me.
My office view in Toronto, you can see the CN Tower, and there's a light that flashes about every 3 seconds. And then you have cars that are moving down the streets that you can see. That happens at faster rates. Maybe there's a self-driving car with a LiDAR system that's shooting out laser pulses that you could detect. You could see the lights coming on and off in the towers at during the day and night cycles. So there's actually a huge range of timescales just out there. And it would be so interesting to see what we can capture simultaneously in the wild.
Oh, yeah. I want him to have that done yesterday.
Me too. And with that, let's end this episode of Carrie the...
I'm sorry, but I was promised more Rebecca a while ago.
Oh, thank you for reminding me. I did want to bring her back to wrap us up with a discussion about how this work happens in the first place.
Everything that I've been describing is research that's been funded by federal research organizations like the National Science Foundation or the National Institutes for Health or the Department of Defense research arms.
Just like how this podcast is made possible through the support of the U.S. National Science Foundation, too.
And there are even benefits to this funding beyond just everyone getting a chance to listen to this awesome podcast.
This has had an enormous positive impact, not only on the research community, but on technologies that we see being used in our everyday lives, in our phone cameras, when we go to the hospital and get imaging done, helping preserve our national security.
100%. Our world is so much better thanks to all the research that is made possible through public funding.
And I thank all the taxpayers across the world that have made it possible for countries like the US and Canada to have helped fund the research that we share today and that we will continue to share in the future. That said, I want to give Rebecca the last word today.
I think that the problems we're discussing are very intellectually engaging and exciting and fun to work on. But I also think that they are legitimately having a positive impact on people's lives, and that those are taxpayer dollars that are really well spent and well invested. And it's been a pleasure to be able to contribute to that.
Don't forget to check out our show notes in the podcast description for more Rebecca, Stanley, and David, including links to all the talks that they each gave at MC and to their work that we described on today's episode.
And if you like the show, give us a review on Apple Podcast or Spotify or wherever you listen. By rating and reviewing the show, you really help us spread the word about Carry the Two so that other listeners can discover us.
And for more on the math research being shared at MC, be sure to check us out online at our homepage, mc.institute. We're also on Blue Sky at mc.institute, as well as Instagram at mc.institute. That's MC spelled I-M-S-I.
And do you have a burning math question? Maybe you have an idea for a story about how mathematics and statistics connect to the world around us. Send us an email with your idea.
You can send your feedback, ideas, and more to Sam at mc.institute. That's S-A-M at I-M-S-I.institute.
We'd also like to thank Blue Dot Sessions for the music we use in Carry the Two.
Lastly, Carry the Two is made possible by the Institute for Mathematical and Statistical Innovation, located on the gorgeous campus of the University of Chicago. We are supported by the U.S. National Science Foundation and the University of Chicago. That's all.
Thank you so much for saying it to me. I will not be sharing that.
What am I, Warren G? Am I trying to regulate?
Sorry. And I was, I'm going to pre-compensate your face. Okay.
It needs compensation.
I got friends at low distances.
Physicists would pick me up on that.
Body slam you. I'm not regular, but I seem to. I'm just have paralyzer stuck in my head.